I didn't think you'd understand.
What part of it wouldn't I understand?
How two people who were married to each other can stay in the same house.
I can understand that. I trust you.
No, you wouldn't.
Try me.
Please, he says.
Just tell me you weren't having sex with him, and I'll believe you. I'm not a suspicious person.
That's when it hits me that he really doesn't know. I look down at my shoes.
Oh, my God,
he says.
Oh, my fucking God, Marnie. I can't believe this. You've done this to me again? How could you do this?
I didn't plan this.
What does that even mean? You didn't set out to crush me? Is that it? But why did you do it?
Oh, God, I am really and truly very sorry. Jeremy, listen. I didn't know when I came here that he was here. And then when he was, I was thinking it was still okay and that I'd come back home next month and you and I would get married and...
That's bullshit. You've been lying to me.
Talking to me almost every day and never telling me anything near the truth.
I'm speechless.
He stares out again at the dismal, dreary street, littered with leaves, and then he turns back to me.
This place sucks. You know that? This is what you're picking, instead of the life we had talked about. This?
It doesn't look so good right now, I admit. But it's really kind of beautiful in its way. You're not seeing it at its best. And under the circumstances... He looks at me a long time, and then he shakes his head.
I've got to get out of here.
I don't think I can take any more. Before you go, can I ask you one thing? Did Noah set you up for this? Did he get you to come?
Wow. You really are delusional, aren't you? I came here because I missed you, you idiot. Because I thought it would be fun to surprise you since I felt bad that you were away for the holidays. Your whole family and I thought this up. That's why nobody's talked to you on the phone for the past week. Because we were all so excited and worried that we'd spoil the surprise.
Oh, I say. Well, this may sound beside the point, but I've always said that I hate surprises. Now I know why. He gives me an incredulous look.
You suck. You know that?
And then he shakes his head and walks down the steps and turns down the sidewalk.
Want me to call you a cab?
I call down to him. But he doesn't even grace that offer with a backward glance, which is fine. I don't deserve anything from him. Nothing at all.
I'm sorry,
I yell.
I'm really, really so very sorry.
He doesn't turn around for that either. 41. Marnie.
I have never heard so much yelling associated with Thanksgiving,
Patrick tells me. He's walking from the kitchen to the living room with a cup of tea, which he hands me, and a teapot.
Well, maybe the very first Thanksgiving had that level of tension. Possibly Miles Standish caused this much trouble with the Native Americans. He was a bit of a brute, from what I've heard. But I'm not even sure about that.
He looks over at me, sitting on his couch with my foot propped up and ice that's supposedly going to help with a bump on my head. He may have forgotten that he's mad at me for the crime of trying to kiss him. At least he let me come here. He even came upstairs and got me, fixed the ice pack, gave me drinks of water, and now herbal tea. Put aside his deadline about colon cancer, he said.
Doesn't matter in the least,
he told me.
People are digesting their turkey dinner, and they should be giving thanks and not rushing to read about colon cancer. Any symptoms they're having tonight are just that they ate too much.
Yet another thing I'm responsible for today.
Oh, you. Stop with the self-pity. It's all going to be fine. For the rest of your life, you're going to have the most exciting Thanksgiving dinner story anyone's ever heard.
Yes. After the madness died down, after I'd gone back inside and screamed at Noah and pulled Bedford away from the turkey drippings, then cleaned up the puke when he didn't stop licking up the drippings, after I'd cried with Lola, who told me I was a traitor, and after I'd tried to persuade Jessica not to break up with Andrew once again, after I'd packed Harry off with his bag of wiggling lobsters that never did get cooked and sent the waitress limping off with her new boyfriend, well, Patrick came upstairs and retrieved me and gave me a place to hide. He checked out the bump on my head, peered in my eyes, asked me some arithmetic questions, and declared that I don't have a concussion. Things may not be fine. There was way too much crying for that. But maybe it's livable. That's the best I can do right now. Patrick walked Lola home. I think he comforted Sammy. I think he may even have cleaned up most of the mess while I was dealing with all the fallout. He tied a piece of gauzy cotton around my head where it might have been bleeding a bit. I feel bad about so many things. Maybe one of the worst things is Lola, who told me in no uncertain terms that she was furious that I'd been conspiring, as she put it, behind her back to get her married off to William Sullivan, aiding and abetting the enemy behind the front lines. How dare I? Helping him write that letter? Encouraging him? Giving him hope, even though I knew her position. Which I did know. She's absolutely right. How could you not have told me you were talking to him? She said. Is there nothing that you matchmakers won't do? But the magic, I wanted to tell her. The sparkles. And then there was Jessica. Well, she was just devastated, plain and simple. Not so mad at me, thank goodness, because how could I have known that the yoke waitress happened to be the woman who Andrew had cheated with? Jessica says it's simply humiliating, her word, that all this time she and I had been friendly with that waitress, and in fact we'd exchanged little tidbits of our lives with her, not even knowing who she was. And, excuse me, not for nothing, but who knew that Brooklyn was such a small town after all? That's what amazed me. That with all the millions of people milling around this place, how our waitress at Yoke could possibly be the woman who had enticed Andrew away from his marriage vows. This might as well be small town America, I tell Patrick. He smiles. Don't, I say, and hold up one finger. Too soon for smiling.
You look sort of jaunty with that bandage on your head, he says. Rather like a drunken sailor.
Did I tell you that after Bedford had dragged the turkey carcass into the living room and I went by there on my way to talk to Jeremy, Noah was taking the opportunity to remove things from the walls and put them in a box, presumably to send to his parents?
Classy Noah move.
Probably just to make me mad. He is sitting at the other end of his couch, as far away from me as he can get, I notice. And he's grinning happily. What's so funny?
I'll tell you. But first, in exchange for all the excellent care and rescue, I need you to tell me every single detail, one by one. And start with what happened with Jeremy.
He says.
That poor guy.
Yes. God, I'm the worst. And of all the things that happened today, the fact that Jeremy came here without telling me and got my whole family to keep it a secret as well, I still can't believe it.
You had no clue?
Patrick says.
None.
Well, he vaguely said a time or two that it was too bad we couldn't be together, and he'd offered to come and help me sell the place.
But nothing like, see you at Thanksgiving, my plane gets in at 11?
Nothing. In fact, I hadn't even talked to him for a week or so because I was so busy worrying about Noah and the Blix stuff. I put my head in my hands. I can't believe I've done this to him. That look on his face.
So did he yell and scream? How did you guys leave it?
He was monumentally disappointed and sad. And yes, he yelled, quite out of character for him. I believe we left it that I suck, which I do. Patrick now actually laughs.
Stop it! Who do you think you're talking to? You weren't ever going to end up with him.
The first thing you told me about him is that he is the most god-awful boring man you'd ever met. I believe those were your exact words.
But boring is not a crime. And anyway, I led him on. And betrayed him.
First of all, you weren't leading him on. You were deciding about him. And I happen to believe that your betrayal, as you call it, was part of the deciding. Also, for the record, I think Blix considered being boring a crime.
He says.
Which it is. I agree.
You're right. She did. She was married to that boring legal aid person. Or was it the boring bug guy? And I told her she couldn't just leave somebody because he was boring, and she said of course she could. She had to, she said. So she did. He reaches over and pours me some more tea from the teapot.
So anyway, we're all agreed that you weren't going to end up with him. And even though this was a shock for him, we have to acknowledge that he bears some responsibility for finding out the way he did. When you set up a surprise, you have to figure that you're the one that might get surprised, right?
I stare at him. Patrick, I am dumbfounded at this side of your personality.
He shrugs. What? I'm just stating the facts. The way I see it, there are no victims here. And also, look at it this way. You've now freed him up to find the true love of his life. And he'll always have a great story to tell about Thanksgiving in Brooklyn. How many people get such a good breakup story?
I hope he'll be all right. It's like he's a person who has his emotions in a safety deposit box somewhere, and he forgot where he put the key. I realize with some surprise that this really is what makes him boring. He's protected himself with layers of emotional padding, tamping down every single true feeling that might cross his mind. Maybe it's because of losing his father at an early age and having that anxious mother he had to take care of. Emotion was a luxury item on the menu, and he couldn't afford it. Even when he asked me to marry him, he wasn't overjoyed, I say slowly. When I said yes, he looked absolutely shocked. Happy, maybe, but mostly shocked. And even when we had sex, it was,
okay, I'm willing to listen to most things, but I draw the line here. Your sex life. I used to have to put on headphones when you and... Oh, never mind.
Sorry. I look over at him and think about him listening to Noah and me making love. Fighting, crabbing about things, making up again. And him knowing all along how Blix hadn't wanted Noah there. Then his phone rings, and he picks it up and says,
Hi, Elizabeth.
He takes the phone into the kitchen.
Yeah, I'm thinking the second week in December, most likely.
I hear him say as he paces the kitchen.
No, I'm renting a U-Haul.
Sure.
No, people do drive in winter. I've heard it can be done. I think the drive will do me good.
Ah, his sister. He really is going to Wyoming. With a U-Haul. I slump down into the couch even farther. I feel exhausted to my very core. My head is throbbing, and now my leg aches where I knocked it when I slipped, and I just want to close my eyes and disappear. And I'm so tired, so paralyzingly tired, and everything I've thought and believed here has been wrong. I don't know what Blix saw in me, but I didn't help anybody. And I'm certainly not a matchmaker. I've lost the one guy who, boring or not, actually wanted to marry me, all because I cheated with the guy who had left me. And I've made a mess of things with Lola, whom I like so much. And somehow I feel like I've even betrayed Blix by not protecting her papers. And because of that, her stupid grandnephew and his unscrupulous family are now going to try to get the will changed. And Patrick, the one person here that I can talk to, who makes me laugh, though he thinks I pity him, is going to move far away, retreating even farther away from people. So much for Blix's plan.
I'm going to drive straight through,
he is saying. He laughs.
Right. It's not like me to stop in public.
And what am I going to do now that I'm not heading home to marry Jeremy? Am I just going to go back home and face my family's exasperation? They'll hear tomorrow from Jeremy what happened. They may even be hearing about it right this minute. He will, of course, move on with his life. So much for the fun little team we were going to create. Working in his office together and being all happily married and going to Cancun when we retire. Why couldn't I have just done that? What the hell is wrong with me anyway? I'll be back in my childhood bedroom once again, seeing the consternation on everybody's faces as they try to figure out once again what I should do with my life. Oh, Marnie.
What are we going to do about Marnie?
And Natalie. Sorry, sis, but I won't be having a baby and raising it right alongside yours. No barbecues by the pool with our tanned, relaxed husbands. I screwed everything up. Of course, I don't have to go back there. Once I leave here, having disrupted and or ruined everyone's lives, I can pick somewhere else to go. Look on the map and select a new location where no one knows the havoc I can wreak. Honestly, I should be required to have a sign on me. Menace. She thinks she's got matchmaking skills. Stay away. I close my eyes. Patrick, as if speaking from a great distance.
Well, yeah. Myself, yes. No, well, not much furniture, of course, but I have the computers.
He laughs.
No, of course I need them. I'm not exactly going to leave them behind.
I open one eye and see the computers across the room, blinking approvingly as I slide away, down into the darkness. Later, I feel something being placed over me, and I struggle to open my eyes. Patrick says,
"Let me make sure your pupils aren't dilated."
He lifts my lids, one at a time, and says,
"Hmm."
"Patrick," I say through a thickness in my mouth, "I don't believe in magic anymore."
"Bullshit,"
he says. "No, it's not bullshit. And I have to go home." I struggle to sit up. Roy has been sleeping in the crook of my arm, and he jumps off the couch. My head is throbbing like there are a million tiny hammers inside my brain. My eyes don't seem to be operational in the usual way.
"Absolutely not,"
says Patrick.
"You need to stay here. You shouldn't be alone with a possible head thing. Come on. You can sleep in my bed. I'll get you settled."
He gently helps me up and leads me to his room, which, even in my sleepy state, I can tell is so spare it's almost monkish. Hardly any lights. And he draws back the covers, and then he puts his hands on my shoulders and sits me down on the side of the bed and takes off my shoes. Then he sits back on his heels. I feel his eyes on me.
"Hmm. Your clothes still have turkey stains all over them. Shall I go upstairs and get your pajamas?"
I don't answer. I just plop down on the bed on my back.
"Right. I know. You can wear one of my sweatshirts."
"Too hot."
"Okay, then, a t-shirt."
There's the sound of drawers opening and closing, and then he's back. I smell his presence more than see him. And he puts something in my hands. A shirt, I realize.
"Do you need help?" "Oh, dear, I hadn't thought much about this part."
"I can do it," I mumble. And then sleep overtakes me again. I am thinking about the computers blinking. But they're not here, are they? Not in here. Patrick says,
No, no. Sit up. Here. All right. I'll do it for you. Lift your arms. I'm going to slide your sweater up over your head. There.
The air is cold on my skin all of a sudden. Then he's sliding a shirt down over my chest and arms. My bra, I think. No one likes to sleep in a bra. Men probably don't know that. I feel like laughing about that, but I can't. And anyway, now he's eased me back down on the bed and is tugging at my pants, which are so tight that he has to yank them. But then they're off, one leg, and then the other is free. And I'm trying not to think of what underpants I have on, that he's seeing. And then the covers are over me. And there was something else I wanted to say to him, but I can't think just now of what it is. And anyway, I'm too tired to get the words out. I'll think about Patrick seeing my underpants tomorrow. And, oh, yes, I want to ask him not to go. I want to tell him that Blix really wants him to stay, that there's other art he could do. I want to try one more last desperate begging thing. And I will, just as soon as I can hold my head up again. Later, how much later, I turn over and the cat jumps down off me. I hear Patrick breathing deeply somewhere, and when I open my eyes, he is right there, next to me, in the bed. I command myself, touch his arm. But I can't tell if that really happens or if I am just thinking it. And then, when I wake up, there is the smell of cinnamon, and Patrick is coming into the room saying,
"How's the head? Did you sleep okay?"
The first words out of my mouth are maybe not the best ones. "What time is it? What's that smell?" Patrick says,
"Deep breaths. I made cinnamon buns."
"Cinnamon buns? I thought I was dreaming. You made them?"
"I made them."
He's smiling at me.
"I also made you some tea, so if you want to get up and come in the kitchen... Or do you want me to bring it to you in here?"
"Wait, did I sleep here?"
"You did sleep here. You bumped your head, remember? So I put you to bed here."
"Of course I remember." And then I remember the rest, how everything blew up, how I don't believe in magic anymore, or matchmaking, or being extraordinary. And that makes me so sad, because I wanted to believe in Blix and all the things she said about me. I wanted to believe I was here for a reason. But I'm not. I feel tears just behind my eyes, and then they're rolling down my face, and my nose is running too. And this is going to be ugly.
"Oh, dear,"
he says.
"Here, come in the kitchen and have some tea and cinnamon buns. Let's get you moving again."
I obediently swing my legs over the side of the bed and look down at myself. Bare legs and a t-shirt I've never seen before. Oh, God. I look back up at him.
"Yes, you're wearing my t-shirt. I couldn't let you sleep upstairs with a head injury. And your clothes had a lot of turkey fat on them."
Ah, yes. Then I sort of remember. Underpants. Being put to bed, Patrick there in the middle of the night, snoring softly next to me. It's all coming back to me. Oh, God. God, God, God. I look around for my clothes, which he hands me, folded neatly in a little pile. "Well, thank you," I say primly. I don't want to look at him, and I wish to hell he'd stop looking at me. Maybe if I don't look at him for long enough, he'll get the idea and head somewhere else. Go scare somebody about cancer or something.
"Well,"
he says.
"Well, you're welcome."
He stands there for what seems like another whole eternity, and then he says,
"So, I'll get out of your way and let you get dressed."
"Okay."
"When you get dressed, come into the kitchen, because I have something of a surprise for you. Well, let's not call it a surprise, shall we? Because that word got ruined yesterday by Jeremy. Let's call it a plan.
Oh, yes. Jeremy. Ugh. When he leaves, I blow my nose on tissues he has by the bed, and then I get up and struggle into my clothes. There are no mirrors in his apartment. It occurs to me that he probably doesn't like to look at himself, which is another thing that threatens to make me cry again. But I comb my hair as best I can. There may be some dried blood here and there. I wish I had a toothbrush. Where are my shoes? Oh my God, I think a real estate agent is coming, and the place is probably a wreck. Please tell me there's not a turkey carcass in the living room anymore. Patrick slept beside me last night. He took care of me. Wait, so Noah had moved out, and yet he came to Thanksgiving, and why was he there again? And Jeremy, I have broken Jeremy.
So this is going to be the way life is for a while. Thoughts showing up in my brain without notice, each one feeling like an emergency that needed to bump the previous thought out of the way. I go into the kitchen, blinking from the fluorescent light. He says. You may want to work with that jaunty bandage before the real estate agent comes. You look a little like a pirate.
There's a bump from upstairs. Noah, I say. Did I tell you he was taking things off the wall yesterday in the middle of everything? Blix's stuff. I'll bet he's back, doing it again.
Well, that,
Patrick says,
that's what I wanted to talk to you about last night. But then my sister called. I have to show you something. Can you follow me?
He steers me over to the back door and unlocks all the bolts, and out on his little stunted terrace, there is a whole stack of cardboard boxes. Three, maybe. Large ones. I look at him blankly. He smiles.
Frankly, this is the most unethical thing I have ever done in my life, but I kind of don't feel bad about it.
But what is it?
The stuff Noah's been packing,
he says.
Blix's stuff. It's all here.
But how did you get it? This is hurting my head even more.
This is my brand of magic.
His eyes are twinkling. I've never seen him look so happy. You magically got the boxes to get on your terrace?
Well, I magically overheard Noah asking Paco if the UPS driver stops at his bodega and if he'd take these boxes since Noah didn't feel like schlepping them to a post office, God forbid, or to a mailing center. And Paco said, sure, no problem. And then I...
You didn't!
I did. I made an arrangement with Paco. He brought the boxes over here. Noah had brought some over to him on Wednesday afternoon, which means they must contain Blix's journal and your letter.
Oh, Patrick!
So we can go through them and take out what we need, or rather what Blix needs us to have, and decide if we want to mail the rest.
Can I kiss you?
No.
He says it so quickly that I laugh. First laugh since the fall. Come on! Technically, we've slept together, so I think I could give you one kiss on the cheek.
He seems to consider this. Well, is it a pity kiss?
No! It's a legitimate thank you for the magic kiss, I tell him, and I go over and stand on tiptoe and kiss him on the cheek. And by the way, just so you know, the other one wasn't a pity kiss either. But then he says he knows pity kisses. In fact, he is all too familiar with pity kisses, pity looks, pity chocolate chip cookies, pity invitations, pity car rides, pity flowers, pity conversations, pity sandwiches. I would argue, but I am not in my right mind. And also, it's time to go upstairs and see the new real estate agent. The person who might solve everything.
42. Marnie.
I'm relieved to see that the real estate agent, Anne Tyrone, is not a Brooklyn hipster. She's motherly, bosomy, and comforting. Not the type to expect perfection in a house the day after Thanksgiving. She's wearing her glasses on a little filigreed chain around her neck, like a proper older lady, and she walks through the house without making a single note, just soaking up the ambiance and looking around. "Lovely. Just lovely," she murmurs. I am pleased to see that no one would know that a near riot took place in here just hours ago, probably thanks to Patrick cleaning everything up. The only hint that there might have been a disaster is that the kitchen floor has a wonderful gleam to it this morning, the gleam of being well-oiled with turkey fat, perhaps. 4 pumpkin pies are sitting calmly on the counter with plastic wrap over them. There is no turkey carcass in the living room. Bedford isn't even there. He was taken upstairs by Jessica to sleep off his turkey hangover, according to a note I see on the counter. So then Anne Tyrone goes upstairs and looks at Jessica's apartment, and then downstairs to look at Patrick's, and when she comes back up, she says to me, "So, darling, how much work do you want to do here before we put it on the market?" I explain about my life, Blix, my head injury, the 3-month legal agreement, my move back to Florida, and I'm about to launch into a speech about my uncertainty about whether that's the right place for me, when she pats me on the arm and says, "So, basically nothing then. Is that what I'm hearing?" "Yes, I can't. I can't do one single thing." "Well," she says, "I think you're going to be fighting the market the whole time. This isn't a good time for sales anyway, blah, blah, blah. And with so much needing to be done, blah, 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 and additional blah. Can't it be a fixer-upper?" I say. "I like the concept of the fixer-upper. We're all fixer-uppers in this building," I tell her. "Seems like we should be sticking together in a place that understands us. But we're not. We're scattering like tumbleweeds, and it may be all my fault." She is polite enough to let all that news go right by her. "I'll try," she says at last. "In the meantime, you may want to do what you can to make it look normal. You know, maybe paint that refrigerator a different color. At least that." "Sure," I say. "Thank you, thank you. Whatever." After she leaves, I go outside. I take down the tattered Tibetan prayer flags and pick up some of the leaves on the stoop. I go down and look at Patrick's door. His curtains are closed, and the leaves are still piled up in the little entryway by the stairs. "Ah, Patrick." I remember hearing the conversation he was having with his sister, the U-Haul truck, his computers going with him, and I feel like crying again. I am going to miss him so much. How is it that I was able to withstand losing both Jeremy and Noah, and yet the thought of Patrick leaving? Patrick who won't touch me, Patrick who is so damaged that he thinks everything is about pity, Patrick who will never go out in public with me ever, pierces me almost to my core. Is this love? Or is it what he thinks it is? Pity. Perhaps mixed with some adoration because he was this tragic superhero trying to save his girlfriend from the fire. He would say I love his story, not him. Not the reality of a man whose soul and body have been burned beyond his own recognition. Lola comes outside on her stoop, and she waves to me, a listless wave. Nothing like before.
"That the real estate agent?" she calls.
"Yeah."
"You're going with her, then?"
"I guess so." "How are you?" I ask her, and she says she's fine. Then she leans over the railing and says,
"I'm sorry I got so mad at you yesterday. It's really my old argument with Blix, I realized. I loved her to pieces, but damned if that woman didn't always think she knew best about everybody else's life. I can't stand the feeling of being manipulated, even by magic. Especially by magic. I know, I say. I'm sorry. I am so sorry. You should feel the same way I do. What she's done with you and Patrick. Well, I say, but it's not going to work with me and Patrick. But she waves her hands over her head like she's trying to bat away a bunch of gnats, and then she goes inside. I head back in, too. The sun is beaming through the windows, making patches of light on the oak floors. I love the bay windows, the brick fireplace, Patrick's graceful sculpture on the mantel. I'm overcome suddenly with the feel of this room and the high ceilings, the staircase up to the kitchen, the little decorative touches, the wainscoting in the kitchen, the way the stove leans just a bit, the soapstone sink that stopped me in my tracks that very first afternoon when Noah was showing me around, before he knew. And may I just say, I love the turquoise hand-painted refrigerator. It speaks to me. This refrigerator. Ah, this house is a sly one, piling up the memories, Blix's and mine. The scarred table with the star carved into it, the little plants on the windowsill, the view of the park and the busy street below. The dust motes drift down, ready to coat everything, as they always have. The light continues to pour in, making shifting patterns on the floor as the breeze moves the ginkgo tree outside, shedding the last of its four leaves, pretending we belong together.
Marnie, it's okay to love him.
No, he won't let me.
It's okay to love him.
Well, my friend, I think we struck out.
I'm at Best Buds the next day, and I look up from deadheading the chrysanthemums, hearing a familiar voice. Sure enough, William Sullivan is standing there smiling and jingling the change in his pocket.
If we struck out, then what are you doing here?
I ask him, which isn't the most polite way I've ever spoken to a customer, I admit. But really? He drives up from New Jersey to tell me how Lola turned him down? Has the world gone barking mad?
Well, I'm here because we've got to try again, he says, his eyes lit up. I thought I'd visit her this weekend, our usual Saturday outing, and I thought you and I could think up something new for me to say to her.
Wait a second. She turned you down, and she was furious at both of us, and yet you still think she's going to be open to your usual Saturday?
Yep.
He smiles at me.
Well, I hope so, at least. I'm going to give it the old college try.
I want to say, what is wrong with you, William Sullivan? What is it about a woman turning down your proposal of marriage that makes you think she'll be willing to go on an outing with you 48 hours later? Instead, I say, wearily, but with a fascination at the obtuseness of the human spirit, so you see this plan involving flowers, do you?
Well, sure, involving flowers. You're a flower shop, aren't you?
All right, I say. I have to say, though, I'm not sure we're going to be able to change her mind. She's pretty convinced she doesn't want anything interesting to happen for the rest of her life.
Ah, I know. That's how she feels now. She's pretty fierce.
He chuckles.
She was something else on Thanksgiving, wasn't she?
Well, yeah, she was pretty upset.
He wanders around the shop, whistling something, and then he comes over to me at the counter.
What did you say your favorite flowers were?
What had I said? Gerbera daisies?
Oh, yes. Okay. I'd like a bouquet of those. And while you're fixing them up, I want to tell you my plan. Because I have cooked up a great one, and I am very optimistic that this is really going to work.
I shake my head. William, I'd sort of forgotten that people can even be optimistic sometimes.
Oh, I'm frightfully optimistic, he says. Frightfully. Okay, let me tell you what I've realized. I was a basketball coach in my old life, and what happened here is that I misjudged the layup. Simple problem. I thought this was going to be a slam dunk because Lola and I were such good friends from before, and we were both lonely, and we had all this history. Good, good history. But no. I hadn't prepared for no. I hadn't thought it all through.
He grins. Well, that can happen.
So, you were right. I sprung it on her. So, I'm going to back up and take it slow, approach her another way. Today, if she'll have me, I'm going to take her somewhere neutral. No big talks, no heavy scenes, not even going to hold her hand. And that's my plan. Just keep seeing her. Do what she wants. Never ask for more, no pushing. I'm going to wait it out, woo her until she's not scared anymore. Not make any big moves, no proposals.
Well, good luck to you. I wish you the best.
Yep. That's the right thing. I'm launching a plan. I call it a year of 100 dates with Lola. We'll go slow, drink a lot of coffee, see some shows, then maybe visit my house, see my friends. Maybe we'll take a little jaunt up to New Hampshire. Stay in separate hotel rooms, drinks by the fire, go dancing, that sort of thing. Whatever she wants, and at a pace she's comfortable with. My goal is to give her something she can't have in her house all by herself. Laughter. Companionship. Admiration.
What she says, though, is that she doesn't want to be disloyal to Walter's memory. That's what you're up against. Uh-oh, here I go, being disloyal again, working behind the scenes. Only somehow I can't help myself. I love this old guy with his optimism. He smiles widely.
But you know, I knew Walter too, and I think he would have been glad for us. He'd like that she's got someone to love her and look after her. We don't have to shut down his memory.
Well, I say, wow, this is amazing. I wish you the best of luck. I'm rooting for you hard. So, you want the flowers to take to her, or do you want them delivered? He smiles.
The flowers are for you, because of the first-rate magic you did.
I stare at him. The magic? You knew about the magic?
Lola told me that you and Blix are matchmakers, and that you work with magic to bring people together.
But the magic didn't work. It was an epic fail. So much so that I'm giving up on magic altogether.
What? That's what you think? Marnie, it's still working, don't you see? It's taking a new route, that's all. When you're as old as I am, you learn a couple of things about love. And one of the main things is that you can't give up on people you love. When you really believe.
I look into his roomy old blue eyes, so lit up that they're practically shooting sparks. But what can you do if the other person has given up? I say. It's hard to talk through the lump in my throat. He says,
well, you just gotta keep trying. That's what you do.
But what if you're running out of time?
Honey, we're all running out of time. And
he lowers his voice like this is going to be momentous.
We also have all the time in the world.
That doesn't really make any sense. He laughs.
I know, it doesn't. I thought I could make some wise pronouncement here, but I got nothing. Well, okay, except this. Here's my bit of old man wisdom for you. You gotta have faith in something, don't you? And when you pick what that thing is going to be, you don't give up on it. Just don't. It fails, you try another way, and then another.
And he takes my hand and kisses it, like a courtly gentleman, and heads out of the store. Then he remembers something and comes back in and pays for the flowers. Once more, I think if I ran over to the window, I'd see William Sullivan doing himself a little dance down the street, laughing and snapping his fingers, although 9 people out of 10 would know that he's got no shot at his plan. But what do 9 people out of 10 know? You know what I miss? I miss seeing those little sparkles, the ones that meant something good was about to happen, that there was love around. I don't know why, but they've somehow vanished. That's all. I just miss that. Natalie texts me the next day while I'm in the kitchen, washing down the turquoise refrigerator in preparation for painting it. The internet says that a person can actually buy special appliance paint that makes old fridges look like they just came from the showroom. This one could look new again, according to some of the more gung-ho commenters. And then this text sails in, which I've been expecting. The big sister weighing in on the disaster that is my life. She who knows best. I don't trust myself to speak with you. Trying to be on your side, but WTF. You broke his heart again? I broke his heart again. Yes. And you are living with your ex-freaking husband? No. And stop yelling. I am not going to stop yelling until you explain what you are doing. Here's what I am doing. I am right now painting a fridge. Bye.
I can't even.
Then please don't. You know what I can't even? I can't paint the refrigerator some cool professional white. I walk to the hardware store and look at the special white paint, and I even go stand in the checkout line with a can of it, but then something happens in my brain. I try to picture Blix's kitchen with a refrigerator trying to pass itself off as a normal fridge, and I can't. Anybody who wouldn't buy Blix's house because they have no feeling for her refrigerator, well, they simply shouldn't be allowed to have it. That's all. I put it back on the shelf and leave. Things that can't be ordinary. Me, Patrick, the refrigerator, William Sullivan. Sorry, that's just how it is. Sorry, not sorry. And where are the sparkles? 43. Marnie. Monday morning is a regular school day, and Jessica and Sammy come banging against the door early, the way they always do. I'm sort of caught off guard, because in my own little mind, everything has changed completely, and nobody but Bedford and William Sullivan and, okay, Patrick, really likes me anymore, and Patrick doesn't count because he's leaving and I won't ever see him again. But there are the two of them, Sammy with his scooter, and Jessica all harried as usual, with her bag over her shoulder and her coffee cup in her hand. As soon as I open the door, she gives me a big smile and starts apologizing for not checking in on me over the weekend. Here you had a head injury and everything, and I'm off sorting out my own little life, not even making sure you weren't in the hospital or something, she says. Then she laughs. Well, I knew you weren't in the hospital, because that real estate lady on Friday said you were perfectly fine. And also, I came to check on you in the middle of the night on Thursday, and found you were with Patrick. She narrows her eyes a little bit when she says his name. The girlfriend body language for, so what was that about? And I shrug in reply, the body language of, it wasn't anything, believe me. Sammy seems distracted, playing with the handle of his scooter and squirming around under his backpack. Every now and then he looks up at me like there's something he wants to say. No doubt he has opinions about how badly our magic project turned out. Join the club, my boy. Stand in line.
All of a sudden, Jessica says, "Listen, I don't really have to be in until noon today. I was just going to go get a haircut. But what if you and I got a little breakfast first? Maybe not at Yolk, of course." She laughs and ruffles Sammy's hair, and he does a comedic googly-eyed look right at me and mouths the word, "Yikes," where she can't see. Marital situations can be so confusing for the little ones, especially the ones who've tried to mastermind adult lives and found it horrifyingly difficult. "Sure," I tell her. "Breakfast it is." I'd forgotten the main thing about being with Jessica, how much fun it is to have a girlfriend who is also living some version of a possibly chaotic life. Most of the time, I have to say, I seem to be the person who can't get it together, the one being left at the altar and then cutting up her wedding dress in the preschool, the one setting out for a strange city and failing at reinventing herself, even there. And yet, here is Jessica, linking arms with me, walking down the street, and she's actually laughing about the whole Thanksgiving catastrophe. She said she and Andrew keep referring to it as "fucksgiving." Like, one thing went wrong, and then it just set off a whole cascade until absolutely everything was shit. Was that basically your take on it, too? From what I can remember, I had a convenient head injury, remember? Oh, yes. Although, you coped masterfully, even after that. As I recall, you took care of pretty much everyone, even through the yelling and screaming. And you solved two of your most pressing romantic problems, both Noah and Jeremy. It was actually kind of epic. One of the only Thanksgivings I've had in which nobody ate any turkey. Or clam chowder either. Or lobsters. Hence, fucksgiving. She smiles at me. By now she's steered us into a little breakfast place, far, far away from Yolk. A waiter has brought us menus and coffees, asking if we want almond milk, soy milk, cream, half and half, skim, or regular milk. And after that question is answered, he'd like to know which kind of sweeteners to haul over. Pink packets, blue ones, yellow, stevia, Truvia, regular sugar, regular raw sugar, or sugar syrup. "I'm going to miss this about Brooklyn," I tell her when we've sorted out our order. "It's a place you can't be indecisive, even about coffee. In Jacksonville, it's so not this way." She runs her fingers through her long hair, shakes out her waves, and stares off into space, her mouth a closed, straight line. She has the kind of hair that should ensure its owner's perfect lifetime happiness. Too bad her hair is not in charge of negotiating her love life, because then nothing would ever go wrong. "So, tell me where things stand," I say. "Andrew's out of the picture, I take it, relegated back to divorced dad status. But I just want to say, well, no, actually," she says, but I don't take it in because I'm talking at the same time, and what I'm saying is, want to say that I think that was really a stupid move for the waitress, that woman, to speak up like that right in front of everyone, to say she was, you know, the one. Jessica is looking at me with her wide blue eyes.
I know.
But you know what else? It made me realize how I am not remotely well enough to love Andrew completely, which I was in such denial about. I was all like, "Oh, our kid is so cute, writing that little poem, and he needs us, and why don't we just forget the past and get back together?" When that was not even realistic.
First fight, and we're done again. Right?
I guess. She leans forward. "So,
bad as this was, it got us to talking, which was painful and excruciating, and I'm surprised you didn't hear us. On Friday, we took Sammy over to my mother's house just so we could fight and yell and scream and get it all out. I don't normally approve of yelling and screaming, but Andrew said we had to air everything, and if voices were raised, then that showed we cared enough to risk it. Or something. Anyway, we did. And at the end of it, hours and hours of talking and pacing and yelling, he said he wanted to keep trying. And I said I did too. And so we are.
Wow. Because what I realized is that I had something to do with the marriage falling apart, too. Here I was blaming him and everything, but I was really the one who checked out of the marriage first. I was bored and frustrated at my job, and I started criticizing him for everything and getting so annoyed with him and ignoring him and doing stuff elsewhere. And he just felt pushed out, plain and simple. And then she was there, and nobody's saying it was right, but I can see how somebody fun and interesting might be appealing when your wife is going to bed at 8 o'clock just so she won't have to talk to you. The waiter comes over with our eggs, and we make room at the table for our gigantic plates, filled with eggs and potatoes and whole grain toast. So, the bottom line is that we've decided we need to be in a different house, not his, not mine, which is convenient because mine is getting sold. But not yet, I protest. You can stay. I'd like it if you stayed, in fact. She shakes her head sadly. Nope, no can do. We need a fresh start, symbolically, if not for anything else. We'll stay in Brooklyn so that Sammy can continue to go to a school where kids are allowed to write poems about breakfast foods to embarrass their parents. I want to start my own business at some point. And Andrew wants us to spend every summer at his parents' cabin in the Berkshires, now that they're getting old. So, big changes. On the way home, I fill her in as best I can on Noah taking Blix's stuff so his parents can challenge the will, and William Sullivan not giving up on Lola, and Jeremy getting furious with me and believing that I'd somehow known all along I didn't want to marry him. She wrinkles her nose. Well, I have to say that I've never been quite convinced of your supposed love for this guy. My family is probably never going to speak to me again. They're all so sure he's the guy I'm supposed to be with. Sorry. Nope, nope, nope. You couldn't have settled for him. I wouldn't have allowed it. And now, I don't care what your family says, you've got other people looking out for you. We're your posse now.
I have a posse?
Yes. And as a spokeswoman for the posse, I say you shouldn't go back to Florida.
There's nothing for you there. You may have to face the fact that, despite all your best efforts, you actually do belong to Brooklyn. But it's dirty here, and cold, and there's trash in the streets, and the subways don't run on time, and you have to go grocery shopping every single day because nobody has a car.
Yeah, she says, punching me in the arm. We're not perfect, by any means, but we're your city. You might as well save yourself some trouble and accept it now.
But Patrick, I think. I can't tell her that part, that there's a hole in my heart. 44. Marnie. As soon as I unlock the front door and walk into the house, I nearly have four kinds of heart attacks. There's Noah standing there in the entry hall holding a cardboard box. I let out a blood-curdling scream, and he jumps in the air.
What the hell are you doing?
That's me.
What the hell are you doing?
Not his most original moment. We stare at each other. Then he says,
I came to get the rest of my great-aunt's possessions. Now, if you'll just move out of my way, I have to take these to Paco's before the UPS guy comes.
Wait, wait just a minute here. What makes you think it's okay for you to do this?
He sighs.
My mother wants Blix's clothes.
Why? Why? What is she going to do with all this stuff? You're just doing this to get back at me is all. I did not talk your aunt into leaving me this building. I did not interfere with her will in any way, shape, or form. And why do you have to be instrumental in contesting a will that you know from Blix's lawyer is legitimate?
He sighs again.
Listen, my family is freaked out, okay? They know that you asked her for a spell, and they think that was tampering with the will. Or something. I actually can't bring myself to pay attention.
So what? I asked her for a spell. I missed you. I wanted you back. What does that prove?
He looks confused for a moment.
Fuck, I don't know. Maybe she felt sorry for you and mad at me, so she changed her whole will.
That was her choice, not mine.
Well, my mother wants the building, and my father has called his attorneys, and now they want all the evidence they can find and also the contents of the house.